Committee members, welcome, and thank you for those of you who got here. I know it was kind of a rush with all of us coming from session, but we want to make sure that we can hear Representative Simon's bill and then two other overviews that we need to go through from the Department of Human Services and from Healthy Homes, part of the Minnesota Department of Health, and then also Sustainable Resources Center. We got a lot to do, and we're going to make sure, Representative Simon, that your bill gets the hearing that it needs. Since we don't have a quorum, we're going to go ahead and let you start, but we won't be able to take any action until we do get a quorum. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And let's see, we need someone to move your bill?
Yes, please, and I think it's going to taxes.
Okay. Representative Brnovich?
I move to move House File
315. Right.
So.
And be referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Referred to the Committee on Taxes.
All right. Go ahead, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I think this is a bill that could really help out a lot of our municipalities.
Representative Simon, could you get a little closer to your...
Sure.
There you go.
Pardon me. This is a bill that I think will be very helpful to a lot of our municipality. It concerns special service districts and housing improvement areas. And I represent St. Louis Park and Hopkins, both of which have used these to great effect over the years, but certainly not only those communities. Many other communities throughout the state have used them, as you'll hear from some of the other testifiers. And until 1996, this authority was granted, the authority of cities and units of government to use these very effective tools, was done on a piecemeal sort of patchwork basis, where there were individual bills floating around in the legislature to give this or that jurisdiction the ability to use one or both of these tools. In 1996, it appears that the legislature got smart about it and just decided to give blanket authority to use these tools, having seen no particular abuse or reason why we would have to do this patchwork. But there was always been some sort of sunset provision. And what this bill would do is just to make permanent that authority. And I should emphasize that the legislature, of course, is always free to pull back, pare back, amend, curtail, cut short, or otherwise change the authority. So that obviously will not change. But there is some hesitation on the part of cities because of this sort of temporary and never really complete authority. So it really is time to come forward and make sure that this authority is permanent. And I think you're going to hear from some of the testifiers here some of the great effects and some of the reasons why the cities really are seeking this this reasonable request. So with that, I'd like, if I could, Madam Chair, to hand it off to Charlie Vanderarty to say a little bit more.
Welcome to the committee. If you just introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Charlie Vanderarty with Metro Cities, an association of 84 cities throughout the metro area. And I actually have the pleasure of working with the League of Minnesota Cities on House File 350. As Representative Simon noted, Minnesota cities have used the Housing Improvement Area Authority to assist condominium and townhome owners who wish to make repairs. At least 10 cities have established housing improvement areas, allowing homeowners to protect their investment by repairing roofs and residential building exteriors, among other improvements. Cities get involved when approached by a majority of property owners who are seeking to assess themselves for these improvements. And joining us today is, I have a member from St. Louis Park that can talk about the housing improvement areas, if she'd like to join us, Michelle Schnicker.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Schnicker. You just give your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Michelle Schnicker. I'm the housing supervisor for the City of St. Louis Park. I'm here today in support of Bill H-350, which would repeal the sunset provision for the housing improvement areas. St. Louis Park has utilized the housing improvement areas as an effective financing tool to assist with the preservation of the city's townhome and condominium housing stock. Housing improvement area financing allows homeowners of properties belonging to homeowner associations to borrow money from the city at reasonable terms to complete common area improvements. The City of St. Louis Park has over 45 townhome and condominium associations, totaling approximately 3,500 units. This comprises about 15% of our housing stock. This is an aging housing stock, and the majority of the units were built in the 70s and the 80s. With at 30 to 40 years old, many of these properties have rehab and maintenance needs. Seeing a need to preserve this housing stock in our community, the first housing improvement area in St. Louis Park was established in 2002. Since that time, an additional six housing improvement areas have been established at the request of the homeowners associations. A total of $12.6 million has been reinvested in nearly 1,100 units citywide. The projects were diverse in size, varying from 20 units to 280 units. Housing improvement areas addressed a number of challenges faced by our homeowner associations. These challenges included underfunded reserves, low association fees, and residents with modest incomes that need affordable payments for improvements. Many of the associations lacked professional management over the years, and they also lacked board expertise. They lack long-term planning. Often the bylaws restrict the amount of internal assessments that can be set, or they have an inability to pass an assessment. Associations also have no collateral. All of the HIAs in St. Louis Park were rejected by at least two lenders due to low reserves, low estimated market values, and low operating budgets. And due to the deteriorating condition of the property coupled with adverse market conditions, property owners have experienced declining property values, making it difficult for homeowners to sell units. For the homeowner associations, housing improvement area financing offers a competitive loan rate, a fixed long-term loan, affordable payment options, including prepayment or annual payments, and a loan that is applied to the individual owners. For the city, housing improvement area financing offers a low-risk means to maintain and preserve the city's townhome and condominium housing stock in stabilized neighborhoods. Requirements in the development agreement ensure that associations remain well-managed, financially solvent, and maintain adequate reserves to meet future rehab and replacement needs. The City of St. Louis Park considers the ability of cities to establish housing improvement areas a vital and important financing tool that assists in preserving and improving an important affordable housing resource in our community. The City of St. Louis Park supports making the housing improvement area statute permanent. Thank you for allowing me to testify for this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Schechter. Do you have any other witnesses, Representative Simon?
No. Okay. Madam Chair.
Questions for the witness or the author? Representative Herzog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, how would these be implemented in terms of, would there be limitations as to how much of the city could be included in this? Is there anything proposed in the statute, or could you end up having the whole city in, mm-hmm. in one of these improvement districts?
Representative Simon.
Representative Hertaus, I'd like to defer to an actual practitioner, if that's okay, to talk about that. He knows far more than I ever will.
Ms. Schechter.
Each housing improvement area is established separately for the association, the homeowners association. So we have approximately 42, 45 homeowner associations, and in theory, each one could establish, could be their own separate housing improvement area. So right now we have seven, and it's seven individual homeowner associations, both condominium and townhome associations. Each association has to sign a petition and has to petition the city council to establish that. So the request and the control to request being housing improvement area is really within the control of each individual homeowners association.
Representative Hertaus.
So you will use the bonding authority of a city to generate the funds to provide the capital necessary to make these improvements? Is that my understanding?
Ms. Schechter.
Yes, actually, we have done both. We have utilized bonding authority, and we've also done internal loans and used city funds to fund, depending on how much the housing improvement area is asking to borrow.
Ms. Pertus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the mechanism for repayment of these bonds will adhere to the properties that benefit from the district, or will they ultimately be repaid by the city as a whole and all of its taxpayers?
Ms. Schechter.
No, actually, it is not paid back by the city. The city really is acting in the role of a lender, and all of the loan plus the soft costs are paid back by the individual homeowners in the association.
Thank you. Representative Hertaus.
And so to speak to that, what enforcement or what provisions do you have in terms of your attaching a lien to the property or being able to affect repayment of those funds as properties are conveyed?
Ms. Schnichter.
The development agreement actually provides that the homeowner association would be responsible in the case of a default, but the way that these loans are paid back, if a homeowner chooses to pay payments over time, they will see a fee on their property taxes every year, and so it's put on the property taxes. So if it's 20-year term, they will pay amortized amount of their loan over a 20-year period. Because it's on their taxes, they are in a first position, so that even if there is a default on that particular property, if the property is sold at some point, that fee does get paid off at the time that the property is sold, and it's carried forward on the property. So the risk is very low for cities of not being paid back.
Representative Pertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I understand this clearly, then there's an unlinked transaction where the city is using a homeowners association that is either established for a new district or one that's already in place and operating. That will be the mechanism that will enforce the collection and repayment of any bonding or any funds that the city assists in providing capital to make these improvements.
Yeah, ultimately the homeowners association does agree to that in their development agreement.
Representative Hurtas.
So then I would imagine that there would be technical language to ensure that before these things go forward and to protect the taxpayers at large, that there would be documentation in the homeowners association or in their covenants that give them the explicit authority to do just that.
Yes, actually, their bylaws have to provide the authority for their board to agree to this, first of all, and they do agree that if it can be future association dues that they collect that will be committed to paying off any defaults.
Ms. Hurtas.
I think that, thank you, Madam Chair. I think that this would be a good tool for communities to be able to have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments for the witness or the author? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this was mentioned when I stepped out. I apologize. I had a constituent. But can you give a little background as to why there was a sunset set in place at the beginning? Representative.
Representative Simon? Or Ms. Schnichter, either, whoever.
I actually don't have the history on that. I'm sorry.
Representative Simon?
Madam Chair, I wasn't here, but here's my understanding is because we had just gone, we meaning the legislature at the time, had just gone from a situation of piecemeal city-by-city adoption via various separate bills, the idea was sort of to ease into it by seeing how it worked and making sure we extended that authority on a general basis for a short period of time. But now that it's been since 1996 and there have been no problems and we see that it does work, I guess the idea is that we no longer need the sunset authority. And I should say, members, and this came up in the Government Operations Committee, though this wasn't your question, it seems a natural springboard to this issue, which is I'm a big fan of sunsets generally. And Representative Pepin, as I said to her in that committee, is sort of the champion in the legislature of sunsets. And I agree with her. I've signed on to her bills. Where I think this is different is I think sunsets are particularly useful when it comes to a one-size-fits-all, command-and-control, sort of St. Paul top-down regulation of some kind. But this very idea is giving authority to cities to do what they want to do with it. And so sunsetting a mechanism by which others have the freedom and independence to do something separate and distinct it doesn't seem to fit as well with the concept of the sunset. At least that's my personal opinion. So I think sunsets are great for either agencies or programs of state government. But when the underlying issue here is whether in other jurisdictions at the local level should have unfettered authority, I say let them do what they're going to do, knowing that we can always yank it from them if there's a particular abuse or there's a particular bad outcome. We always have the freedom to curtail or shorten or alter in some way. So that's how I sort of square it, at least philosophically. I know that wasn't your precise question, but that issue, general issue, came up in the last committee.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Well, we do have a quorum now, and so Representative Brnovich, if you want to renew your motion.
I renew my motion to...
I should ask, is there anybody in the audience who wants to oppose this bill? I'm sorry, I forgot to ask.
Taxes.
Okay. Actually, and let me just make an official call of the meeting to order since we have a quorum. The meeting is called to order. And now, if you would renew your motion.
I renew my motion to move House File 350 to the Committee on Taxes.
Okay, any further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and you're on your way to Tax Committee, Representative
Madam
Simon.
Chair, members. Thank you.
See, who's had a chance to look at the minutes? Representative Schumacher, you were here early. Okay? Representative.
I can move them too, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Schumacher moves the approval of the minutes from the last meeting. Any discussion, corrections? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Members, we have a couple of presentations, and we're going to ask our presenters to be comprehensive but also quick since we lost about a half an hour of our committee meeting. So the first presentation is from the Department of Human Services. This is an overview of some of the housing initiatives that we didn't get covered in the last time they were here. And members, as they're coming forward, let me just indicate. We attempted to have a housing tour a few days ago, and it, I guess it was yesterday, and it didn't work. A number of meetings were called that caused some of you not to be able to come, and so we canceled it, but we're going to reschedule it. And I want to say that what we decided to do, and with your approval, just for a moment discussion here, we're thinking of doing it during our committee hearing time, so it would be a time that you already have set aside for this hearing. For that purpose, and it would be March 4th, and we might ask you to come like a half hour earlier, from 11:30 to 2, if we could, if we could leave at 11:30. We're going to tour some of the places that you have indicated you wanted to go. I know, Representative Hirtash, you wanted to go to Portico, you mentioned that. There's a few other places. We're going to stop at a couple of shelters. We're going to see some of the other kind of housing situations that we've heard about in this committee. So I'm not asking you to say too much right now, but just if you could try to put it on your calendar either for March 4th, which would be Monday, or March 6th, which would be Wednesday. I'm a little leery to do Wednesday because like today we got here a half hour late, so I'm thinking if we do it on a Monday, if you could just let Martha know, and we will go ahead and make the arrangements with the folks. We had a really good response from people who wanted to show you around. So I appreciate that, and some of it will be just, we're going to be both in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and maybe Maplewood, we'll see. Okay, so let's go forward with the testimony. And
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just a point of order. Now that we have a quorum, I'll just move to approve your minutes.
Oh, we just did, Representative Hirtash.
Excuse me?
The minutes?
Yes.
Yeah, we just approved them.
Okay.
Thank you.
I thought he moved to move the bill.
Actually, Representative Schumacher.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. All right. Go ahead and introduce yourself, please. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. You asked me to come and speak with you today about all of the housing programs that are administered by our department with respect to housing, and I am prepared to do that in a high-level overview. I will let you know I'm not a subject matter expert. There are subject matter experts in the room if you do have detailed questions. What I thought I would do is try to give you a high-level overview, and you have materials with you, and then when we get through that, do questions if that works for the committee. In the earlier hearing, we focused primarily on group residential housing and homeless prevention programs. Today, I'd like to give you a broader overview and put the programs in context. What you will see is that we have 17 different programs that we administer related to housing or housing support services. We serve the following populations through the work that we do: homeless individuals and families who lack a regular nighttime residence, unaccompanied homeless youth, individuals who are age blind or 18 and disabled, and individuals with serious mental illness, including those with co-occurring substance abuse or disorders who are experiencing homelessness or at risk of homelessness. We also support residential care provided by licensed facilities. I'm not going to talk about those issues today. As I mentioned, we administer 17 different programs. A lot of the work that we do is, of course, allocating or distributing resources that are provided either by you here at the state level or the federal government. And we allocate resources in three different ways. We provide direct assistance to individuals. We provide direct payments to housing providers on behalf of eligible recipients. And we also contract with nonprofits, counties, and tribes as we do this work. On page 4 of the handout, what you see is a continuum of supports summarizing the programs that I'll briefly describe today as we go through the continuum of services by levels by types of persons served. I'm hoping this provides the committee some context or orientation as we get into the specific programs to be discussed. So as you can see along the top of the continuum, we have emergency housing programs, transitional housing, permanent housing, housing supports, and we serve youth, single adults or older adults, and people with disabilities, and then we have some programs that are serving families in our state. To make matters even more complex, the housing programs that are supported by the department are housed in different areas of the department. A number of different divisions provide support based on the needs of the population served and by the delivery method. On page 5, you will find a list of the divisions, and I know you're not interested in the structure of the department, but I think this is important to know in terms of we provide specialized oversight given particular populations that appropriations are provided for. For example, the Aging Division and Board of Aging provide transitional supports for persons returning home from nursing homes, and the Adult Mental Health Division works with local mental health authorities to support people with mental illness who've been hospitalized at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. Now I'm going to go into a little bit more detail on each of the programs. And what you will see in the following next several pages is some more detailed information regarding the programs. It'll identify the program, the population served, a description of the program, how the grants or the funds are managed, who's eligible to receive the funds, and what is the legal authority for administering the programs. As we discussed a few weeks ago, the largest housing program administered by the department is the group residential housing, and that is about $252 million a biennium. And as a reminder, GRH supports individuals who are aged, blind, or over 18 and disabled, and those who are eligible for supplemental security income or general assistance. This is a forecasted entitlement program that provides an income supplement issued to vendors on behalf of an eligible individual to pay for housing and services, as well as a small personal needs allowance for the individual. On page 6, you also see a summary in that chart of that program and two subcomponents, including the group residential long-term homeless program, which provides resources for those individuals who meet the definition of long-term homeless who've been homeless for a year or four times in the last 3 years. And finally, the group residential metro demonstration that provides support for people with mental illness or history of substance abuse and provides resources similar to what you'd see in Section 8. On page 7, there's information regarding the Minnesota Supplemental Aid Housing Assistance, formerly known as the MSA Shelter Needy. This program is also an income supplement. It provides up to $200 a month, but this is only for eligible individuals ages 18 to 65 who have housing costs that exceed 40% of their total income, and for those who are relocating from an institution or are eligible for medical assistance, personal care assistance, self-directed services, or home and community-based waiver. Also on page 7 is the long-term homeless supportive services grants, which is about $11 million a year, a biennium to counties and tribal collaboratives. These resources provide case management and other supports to assist individuals in finding and maintaining housing. On pages 8 and 9, there are describe about $9.4 million per biennium of state and federal funding for housing support services that are administered by our Office of Economic Opportunity and administered by community action agencies, nonprofits, and local units of government. And these funds are allocated on a request for proposal basis. The two programs on page 8, Emergency Services Program and Emergency Solutions Grant, are the state and federal programs that support emergency services such as service costs of overnight shelters, motel vouchers, and day shelters for the homeless, as well as essential services to homeless children, families, and individuals. And again, you can see more data in terms of the people who receive those services. The program at the top of page 9, which is the Transitional Housing Program, provides rental subsidies and support services to homeless individuals and families to attain and maintain permanent stable housing. Participants in this program are required to pay at least 25% of their household income for rent, and the program is limited to 24 months of service. The second program listed there is the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, which provides state street outreach, drop-in center programs, emergency shelter, transitional living programs, and our supportive housing for unaccompanied homeless youth. And as you can see there, this is a small program currently funded about $238 million for the biennium. The third program on that page is the federal support for rural homeless youth. This is a small demonstration program provided with federal funding for the first transitional living program on reservations in Minnesota to address racial disparities with American Indian youth within the homeless youth population. And this program is provided by Lutheran Social Services in Brainerd and on the Boys Fort and Leech Lake Indian reservations. The next slide, I talked more about last time I was here, so I'm going to keep this as very brief. This is the Healthy Transition and Homeless Prevention Program that I talked to you about early, which is a federal, state, and grant program of about $1.8 million a year to focus on current and former foster youth who are age 16 to 21 who've been in the child welfare system to help them with transitional services and to support their moving into adulthood in the community.
Excuse me, members. I just wanted to point out, Mr. Mara pointed out that page, I think, is missing from your bigger packet, but it is on the smaller packet. So if you look on page 2 of the smaller print package, it would be page 12. So there
you
go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now I'm moving on to programs that are administered in our adult mental health area. Pages 11 and 12 provide information specific to supporting adults with serious and persistent mental illness. Each of these programs on this page are small targeted grants of between $1.2 and $1.5 million for the biennium. The first program, the Adult Mental Health Crisis Housing Assistance Program, provides up to 90 days of crisis housing assistance for persons who require inpatient or residential care for stabilization. Assistance in this program includes mortgage, rent, and utilities, and is provided through a grant contract to a nonprofit organization who reimburses individual applicants for their housing costs. The second program is the Supportive Housing Services for Adults with Mental Illness that provides grants to support increased availability of a range of housing options with supports for persons with serious mental illness, including transitional services, case management, etc. On page 12 are a couple of additional programs in the adult mental health area. One is the Projects for Assistance in Transition from Homelessness, which provides federal and state funds for people with serious mental illness, including those with co-occurring substance abuse disorders, who are experiencing homelessness or at risk of becoming homeless. Services in this program include community-based outreach, mental health, substance abuse, case management, and other support services to help people maintain living in the community, as well as a limited set of housing services. The second area is a competitive RFP that supports the Bridges Regional Treatment Center pilot for people who have serious mental illness who have been hospitalized at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center and who do not meet the hospital level of care. And these resources help people transition to community housing. The next area that I want to move to is programs administered in the continuing care area of the department. Minnesota has a number of programs for older adults and people with all disability types who want to transition out of an institution or into a more integrated community setting. And these programs are described on pages 13 and 14. The first is Moving Home Minnesota. It's a federal Medicaid five-year demonstration project that's just beginning, and this would provide over $5 million a year for Medicaid recipients who resided in an institution at least 90 days and want to return to the community. Individual services help people transition from institutional care, and services would be paid through the Medicaid. Many of you may have heard of this program as Money Follows the Person. That's been talked about, I know, in the legislature in the past. The second area is housing access services for adults eligible for medical assistance, home care, or home and community-based service waivers. There's just over $900,000 in grant funding to the ARC of Minnesota to help eligible adults move to homes of their own, including finding and moving to, setting up, and then keeping a home of their own. On page 14, the first program I want to mention is the Relocation Service Coordination Program, which serves waiver recipients who are moving to their own home from a licensed setting. That could be adult foster care, family or group foster care, hospitals, intensive rehabilitation treatment settings, and the like. The services that are covered under this program include essential furniture, lease or rental deposits, one-time household supplies, one-time treatment to the home if there's issues related to allergies, supports for transitional assistance, utility setup fees, and deposits. You don't have a dollar figure there, so I want to give one to you. That expenditure is about $16 million a biennium, half of which is state funds and half is federal Medicaid dollars. For private individuals who are not on medical assistance but who've been in a nursing home less than 90 days, they can be served by the Return to Community Service Grants, which is just over $2 million a biennium. And these services are provided by the Senior Linkage Line Specialist, and those specialists assist residents in person with the transition from a nursing facility to the community. The service results in savings to medical assistance by reaching people before they become eligible for MA and helping them use their own resources more effectively. So that's a very high-level summary. On the next two pages, given the number of programs that are related to housing, I wanted to give you in a snapshot kind of a picture of the state and federal funding for all of those programs. There's, and as I mentioned, on the second to last line on page 16, the Relocation Service Coordination, again, is $16 billion for the biennium, half of state and federal funding. There's one other very small component that I have not included in the charts. This has to do with chemical health. There is a small amount of funding that is issued through an RFP to award a limited number of chronic and homeless grants, but that title is a little bit misleading because those grants really don't pay for housing, but they pay for treatment, and there may be some funds available to help for things such as a security deposit or up to 2 months rent when other resources have been exhausted, and that's there are only four providers who provide that service. Again, it's primarily treatment with a little bit of resources for housing. There's the financing charts. And then the other thing I just want to mention, I think I mentioned what I met with you a couple weeks ago. The governor does have one budget proposal in the Human Services budget related to housing, and that is the Housing Stability Services Demonstration, which is part of the Reform 2020 effort. And what this request is a proposal to capture federal funding for services to low-income adults with chronic health conditions and who lack stable housing that will provide coordinated services across multiple systems and provide tenancy support and community living assistance. The waiver has been submitted, and the department's currently in the process of negotiating the various components of that waiver. The two target groups of this component are individuals who receive general assistance who are disabled or advanced age and homeless, and those who are eligible for GRH and live in registered housing and services established, developed specifically as part of the state plan to end homeless. If the Medicaid waiver is approved, the supplementary cost for services such as case management would be paid for by the by Medicaid, and that would result in savings to the state appropriation for GRH. So as you can see in this very quick high-level overview, There are a number of programs within the Department of Human Services that provide resources for housing and housing supports, very much targeted by population, and that's why you see the administration kind of across the agency. If there are detailed questions, we would be happy to take them. And again, there are some subject matter experts in the room to help me do that.
Thank you. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, it's kind of breathtaking to look at all the services we offer and just see, I think, the myriad of ways we're finding an opportunity to be of service to folks that are in need. And I applaud you guys for the work you guys do over there. I think it's fantastic. And I want to make sure that we have that component of our society in terms of how our government can be of service is held strong. And I'm just curious, you know, to the level to which you have that information in front of you, can you tell me what, over the last 5 or 10 years, has been the rate of your funding in terms of, has it been stable? Have we been seeing cuts, which I'm assuming is what your answer would be? Can you speak to that at all?
Madam Chairman, Representative, I can't give you program specifics, but as you said, we have seen some reductions in many of our human service programs over the past several years.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. I believe there was another question. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for our testifier. As I'm looking at the numbers that you presented here, that is coming out in your funding chart, the proposal that I'm imagining is the governor's proposal, do any of the programs, and I'm talking more toward pages like 15, 16, in through that area there where you've got all the programs listed individually, are those rates the same as they were for the last biennium? Are any of them reflecting increases for the current biennium, or are they reflecting increases over the previous biennium?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm looking at from my finance person. I do not think that the governor's budget is recommending any increases in these existing programs.
So we're looking at. Thank you, Madam Chair. So at this point in time, the governor did not have any increases. Do you know the governor, we've seen such an increase in homelessness over the last 4 years. Do you know why there were no recommendations to increase funding in these areas at all?
Madam Chair, a representative, what I can tell you is within the Department of Human Services, there was priorities, obviously, made in recommendations to the governor. My understanding, and I would ask your able assistance to help you with this, my understanding is that the governor's budget does have recommendations for increased funding related to housing in other areas.
Okay.
But I would double check that.
Okay. If we could get clarification on that, that would be very helpful. May I ask, or
Representative Fisher.
One other thing I'd kind of like to point out, the Runaway Homeless Youth Act. I know there was a press conference on that yesterday asking for $8 million for that area. And when I take a look right now, there's $238,000 that's proposed for the biennium. And when you take a look, that according to Wilder, there's approximately 2,500 youth on the streets any given night. So when you think last night, you think tonight, 2,500 youth throughout the entire state. And it doesn't matter if it's a community. I've heard of people who have been in Washington County and northern Minnesota, southern Minnesota, where they're dealing with nowhere to go. And when you take a look at $238,000 and the needs of 2,500 people, that comes down to about 13 cents a day that we're currently funding. And so I would advocate that to this committee as we're going forward that we look very hard at this issue and figure out ways that we try to increase some of these areas. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I might say one of the places we're going to stop on the tour, I think we'll probably get to see where I believe Representative Hertaus had recommended we visit a place where they're actually trying to do some service for some of the folks that are there. They take a small bite out of what's needed, but we will see how it can work. Was there anybody else? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, a lot of the programs you discussed here have to do with, or have some level at least of federal funding, and one of them, the continuing care program, was one half federal funding. Are those funds already encumbered, or if sequestration occurs, may there be cutbacks in your levels of federal funding?
Madam Chair, Representative, it depends on the source of funding. Some of the entitlement funds, as my understanding is that they will not be subject to sequestration, but discretionary funds would be. and we could get back to you in terms of specifics here. Many of the programs in the continuing care area are the federal funds are Medicaid funds, so those are entitlement funds.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a question maybe for you, the Chair. Are all of these funds within our jurisdiction or are these outside of our jurisdiction? Well, she had 2 pages worth of funding.
Yeah, these funds are in the Department of Human Services budget, but we will be hearing the bills that have housing in them that go to the Department of Human Services budget, just like we hear bills that, you know, go to 2 or 3 different committees. So we will have a chance to hear them and you know, act on them, but the actual committee to which that has the major jurisdiction will be the Department of Human Services for these.
Thank you. And then I do have one question
for
the taxpayer. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I know a question had come about cuts to that you had mentioned that you would receive the department had received cuts, and I just want to clarify, was that cuts from the base or was that cuts from projected spending? Because there's a big difference, you know. Just for example, $1 million is the base spending for 2010, and was the cut that you're referring to below that base, or was it in the projection of 6-7% expenditures?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, I think probably the safest way is because I was talking in general, and you know the size of the human services budget.
Yes.
It's probably a combination of both. We had, and we could get back to you with respect to the individual programs if you're interested in that. But as the legislature and the previous governor worked to address budget pressures, there were reductions in programs as well as adjustments in terms of projections.
Follow-up, please.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. From my recollection, from the previous biennium at least, it was a 6% increase in spending overall for the department. Would that be closer to accurate from the base?
Sullivan Sutton, look like you're going to get a little help here.
Yep.
Go ahead and have a seat if you'd like to testify.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, I think one of the questions is whether your question is related to these programs specifically or the department overall.
I guess the
Representative O'Neill.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the question would be, when you referred to that you'd receive cuts, were you referring to overall the Department of Human Services, or were you referring specifically to these?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Madam Chair, Representative, I was referring to some reductions in programs, and you know, with the health care spending, there may have been some increases, but I would have to have our budget director or finance officer, Chuck Johnson, get back to you with more details on that.
And Representative O'Neill, we will be getting into the details of these particular programs, and we have that part of the bill before us. So it'll be coming next week.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think there's a great distinction between the base mm-hmm. versus projections, and you know, those of us that come from the private sector don't understand that a lot of times when people are saying cuts, they really mean projected spending, not from the base. So if your base spending is, like I said, $1 million in 2010, a cut would be below $1 million for the next spending year. And so when we say cuts, we need to understand what we're talking about. Are we really talking about true cuts? Or are we talking about cuts from the projected spending? That's the distinction that's trying to come to.
That's a fair question and a fairly easy to answer, I think, and we'll have that. It sounds like we're going to get that information for you shortly. Members, I have 2 people who want to ask a question. We'll do it. I can ask you to be kind of brief, and then we want to go on to the rest of the testimony. We will have a chance to go back and visit this budget. Representative Isaacson and then Representative Fisher. And then if you don't mind, I'd like to move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and fellow members that I know I can count on to make sure our numbers add up every time. I am very grateful because that is an important component. I appreciate your thoughts on the cuts. I think on a bigger picture, though, the problem isn't, for me at this point, it needs to be the spending, I think, also needs to reflect the need when we're talking about homeless youth. And so regardless if the cut was of the increase or the cut was of the base, for me personally, there's a much more important human factor that we need to take into account here. And that's something for me that really dictates and drives the way I'm going to be approaching our budgeting on this. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Fisher?
And I'll be very quick. Representative O'Neill is asking if there have been cuts, et cetera. One thing I can tell you for sure, that the Runaway Homeless Youth Act, when it was first funded, was funded for $1 million for the biennium. And we're seeing it at 238. for this current biennium and for the one going forward, we're seeing it at 238. I'll let people draw their own conclusions from that.
And I can say that was a base budget. But one of the problems that has happened in recent years, I can just say, and you can confirm this if you choose to, but a lot of the funding that used to be for the biennium and maybe into the next biennium have become one-time funding, and that's limited. So we don't have a lot of projected extra funding that we're looking at. It's mostly one-time funding in a lot of these arenas now. But we'll go through that and make sure that we all know the difference. So, members, if it's okay, unless there's a burning question, I'd like to move on to the other presentation. This will be from the Minnesota Department of Health, their Healthy Homes Initiative. Thank you, Ms. Sullivan-Sutton. I appreciate your coming. Welcome to the committee, if you indicate your name, please. And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Hogan. I'm the Assistant Director for the Environmental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. And with me today is Dan Simonic, Program Manager of the Lead Surveillance and Healthy Homes Program. Thank you for having the Minnesota Department of here today to provide an overview of healthy homes activities that have been occurring. Having a healthy home allows the citizens of Minnesota to build a healthy, productive lives. Through funding provided to the department by the Centers for Disease Control, the department has brought together a broad spectrum of government and non-government organizations to work on the issue of healthy homes. This collaboration has begun development of a framework for addressing healthy homes in Minnesota. Mr. Simonic will provide an overview of the department's activities or involvement in these activities.
Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the tape, please.
My name is Daniel Simonic. I work at the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you, Madam Chair. As we kind of begin, just a little bit of background, we heard some testimony from the Department of Human Services regarding all of their different housing activities, each targeted towards a specific subpopulation that has their specific risks. And that's important that we do that because those populations have those risks. I guess as a public health agency, we are more looking at a broader approach to the general population. So rather than, and while there are high-risk populations and there are people that we certainly will be focusing on, we're kind of trying to bring that benefit of the healthy home and the healthy behaviors kind of to everyone across the state. So we begin with our background that the housing laws going back in the 19th century, really this is not a new concept that health and housing be together. It's kind of where it started, and I think over time we kind of drifted apart and we're beginning to recognize that we have to bring things back together, that housing and health really are linked together for issues like cholera, tuberculosis. Back in the early 1900s, it was as simple as providing light and fresh air really reduced the incidence of diseases, and the lead paint hazards were observed in medical journals as early as 1914, which is well before it was addressed as an issue, and that's a very long story for another day. But these are not new concepts of housing being connected to health. You can see Florence Nightingale there with her quote. There has been a track record of success in dealing with some of these issues. What you see up there is the lead poisoning prevention numbers. The graph on the top is the number of kids who have been tested running from 1995 up to 2011. You can see that we've tripled the number of kids in a decade that are getting a lead screen. So we're able to get the medical community to engage with us and get those kids tested. The lower graph are the number of kids with elevated blood lead levels, and you see that graph is also going in the right direction. We continue to make progress, and that's consistent with the trends that are across the entire nation. And we've done that through engaging with housing communities, with working with the healthcare providers, with getting guidelines and scientific data out there and doing surveillance as a public health program. It really is something that has been a success, but we have more to do in the field. regarding that, our funding from the Centers for Disease Control that we had been getting for 18 years came to an end last fall, and that again is a whole nother discussion as to why CDC chose to do that, but our support for our surveillance and education and outreach and guidelines really came to an end last year, and so we are looking to be able to keep that capacity going. As part of that, we had recognized as those number of lead cases get lower, we recognized that to take that capacity and address it to healthy homes, don't just do one thing when you go in the home. You're in there, you have an opportunity to address more than one health issue. Do the things that are necessary to make sure that the home is safe. You can see the other federal agencies, the data that we collected really does leverage HUD grants, it leverages EPA grants, Medicaid testing, so there's a lot of different programs that we really rely on that data to bring additional money into the state. Now the Surgeon General has weighed in on exactly what is a healthy home. The concept of healthy, even the concept of home, is kind of a, you know, to the observer. So the Surgeon General said a healthy home is designed, or sited, designed, built, renovated, and maintained in ways that support the health of the residents. Now what I'll point out is, unlike a lot of definitions where it prevents asthma, prevents lead poisoning, it's kind of a negative, it stops all these things, this is more of a positive view. It really sets out a goal that we should be striving for, and I think that leads to a whole different tenor in the program. The National Center has kind of further taken that a little further as to what they believe a healthy home looks like, and you can see the seven items there. You know, as you look down that list, you can see that, you know, that is common sense. I understand they've added an eighth, which is thermally controlled. So able to maintain your temperature, which actually is an issue with extreme heat events and those kinds of things. And so that also can have a housing issue. So the types of things that we're talking about here, you can see the list there of asthmas, allergies, injuries, smoking in the home, the mold, that middle picture there, those little black dots, that's actually mold up on the ceiling. That every time I put that in a presentation, I just kind of get the willies on that one. Mm-hmm. And so rather than just focusing on lead poisoning, really by taking this approach, it allows us to get traction on all of these different public health issues. In doing that, with our one, we did get 1 year of funding from CDC to do healthy homes. We funded some pilot studies with our partner agencies out across the state. You can see the counties that are labeled in blue there. Those are the ones we gave the pilot studies to, where we tested out how to do the assessments, what sort of issues were out there, were we able to bring communities together around issues that mattered to them. So essentially, this just like the issues are not new, kind of our methods, we've been trying to ensure that we put something in place that's going to work. And what we found is, and there's a lot of data on here, we won't go through it all, you can look later, but the gist of it is it's not just back in 1914 that we had really issues in homes that affected health. These are homes that we tested over the last couple of years, and you can see the types of things that are reported. Only 7% of the homes have actually been tested for radon, but yet 1 in 3 homes in Minnesota have issues for radon. So that means if you're okay and you are less, look to your left and look to your right, one of them has high radon in their house. We've recently discovered there is no safe level of lead. The recent literature shows that they've had to completely change the way they look at it as a toxin. There is no number anymore where it's like, well, once you're below that, you're okay. Any level is showing more increased threats. Asthma and dust mites. 84% of homes in the U.S. have dust mites. I ran across that, and I'm like, sometimes when you're in this field, when you go home, you just kind of don't want to know some of this stuff. but it is important that, because these are issues that can improve our health. Another pilot project we did that is funded by the EPA addressing radon, where we're working with people in child care facilities to kind of get a basic message where they have some early exposures in their life. You can see promoting an integrated approach, and I think that's kind of the theme that goes throughout this, is by integrating we can get some traction on a range of public health issues as opposed to just working in the silos. You can see the outcome here. By working with 1,000 child care providers, we can get some of those folks in there tested for radon and get the knowledge and get the tools in their hands to be able to create a safer home environment. Now, one of the things we've done in preparation is put together a strategic plan, and I did bring a copy here. If anybody's interested, we'll be happy to send them, but as you can see, it's kind of long. We went around the whole state to gather feedback on this. and Sustainable Resources Center, who you'll hear from in a minute, helped us do this. And there are a number of priorities that are set in there. But what the plan basically is what to do. We got experts together and said, so what should we do? What are the steps? What are the priorities? What are the issues we should address first? That's kind of in the plan. The next step in order to have a plan work, of course, is it doesn't do you any good to have a plan that just sits on a shelf. You actually need people to go ahead and implement it. And the folks who will do that, we hope and expect, will come out of this Alliance for Healthy Homes and Community. And again, Sustainable Resources Center will talk more about that. But it's a group of organizations that have come together who will be implementing that plan and actually be the folks on the ground implementing it. So, as a program, what we're looking at as a goal is to reduce long-term health care costs and increase social capital by improving that home environment. And so it really goes to health care costs. It goes to people feeling more comfortable in their communities and being healthy, and that then has cascading benefits that go throughout. The way the program would be put together, this again is nothing new. There are many programs at MDH that are put up on this very same structure with data collection, make sure we have sound information, that we're using good science to make decisions, we're connecting to services, make sure that people are available, and get hooked up with the things that they need to get help, and then primary prevention. And that's a key public health thing. It's always better to stop it from happening in the first place than to have an effective response once someone gets ill. You see some of the other agencies that we've already talked to that have agreed to that this is a good idea as far as sharing the data. When we go in and do a home assessment, there's no reason for four agencies to go in and get an address or to go in and determine that there's mold in the basement. One of us should do it and then share that information. That just is much more efficient way for the agencies to run. MHFA with their home loan rehab program, they already are implementing green standards and lead safe work practices, so they're doing that. Public health nurses are amazing ambassadors for public health out in the community. Those people know everything. It's amazing. And so getting them the tools to be able to recognize some of these things when they go into a home. And the fire safety. We have a woman we work with up in Spring Lake Park who goes after there's a fire on a block, she will go a couple weeks later and invite the neighbors to get a home safety test. And she says, boy, you'd be amazed how motivated they are when they just saw their neighbor's house burn down. So as she goes in there, she is welcome into their home. She begins to observe pests. She observes mold. She observes whether they have smoke alarms up. And so there's another way where the fire and safety people have recognized that their cost, they've had 28% less fires in her jurisdiction because she goes out and prevents them before they happen. So her fire chief is happy because he doesn't have to respond to that many fires. So I guess in summary, it does provide a foundation on which they can build a healthy home. We put the triangle there where, everybody's concerned about jobs, and rightfully so. But in fact, if your community and your home aren't acting as a good foundation for that, it really kind of is about jobs in a way. And a multi-agency approach. Now, it's MDH. We're here kind of pitching this, but this isn't something we can do alone. Every agency really has to pitch in and does have a role to help and make it work. And really, the money spent does return many fold down the road. As far as avoided medical costs and work days avoided, and so it's really kind of not a cost. We like to look at it as an investment. And we have a couple websites, and I apologize for how fast that went. We'll be happy to discuss with anybody at length if you
need
more information.
Thank you. You did a good job. You covered a lot of territory. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Could you talk a little bit more in depth about the radon testing in homes, cost, how it's done, who would do it, and about the remediation if there's a higher level?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, there is a short-term and a long-term test. The short-term takes on the neighborhood of 3 to 5 days. You hang it in the basement. You then send that in and get your number back. The threshold is 4 picocuries. Per meter, cubic meter of air. And so there is a number established with that it is above. The remediation basically is to get the outside of your home to have lower pressure than the inside of your basement, because hot air rises. As the hot air rises, the soil gas around your basement then comes in to the basement, and the radon is in the soil gas. So what you basically have to do is you put a hole in the foundation, put a pipe up to the top, put a fan on it. That creates negative pressure outside the basement, so the air doesn't come in, the air in your house goes out, and as long as the air is going out, the radon can't get in. And so basically that's how you stop the radon. And we actually have crossed another interesting threshold. We find out all sorts of cool numbers as we get ready for these things. That we, the number of people who die from radon is now higher than the number of people who die from car crashes.
Is that a Minnesota statistic or an?
That's a national statistic.
Thank you.
Although Minnesota is one of the highest risks for radon in the country.
That's great. That's right. Aren't we the highest or one of the highest?
One of the highest, I believe.
Okay. Representative Anderson? Okay. Other comments, questions? Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you stated in 2012 the grants for prevention of childhood lead ended, and now you're transitioning to healthy homes. Can you talk a little bit about that transition, how that is going, if you can?
Mr. Simonet?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, we, based on the expertise we have in lead, we are able to, with the current general fund that we have, kind of sustain it through the end of the biennium. With our surveillance database, we have 100,000 reports come in a year. With some of the training with partners out there, with putting together the strategic plan and bringing partners together, we certainly are looking to sustain that core lead capacity and then bring these other issues together. So we feel like we're making progress, but we're kind of at a point now where we know where we need to go. We just kind of need the resources to be able to implement it and to kind of get out there and make it happen in the field.
Madam Chair, so are there high incidents of lead in homes still? Is that still an issue, a big issue?
Mr. Sunak?
Madam Chair, Representative, within certain populations within the city, yes, we do still recommend that every child under age 6 in Minneapolis and St. Paul get a blood lead test because it's essentially homes built before 1978, and of which there are a little over a million in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And so children living in those homes are potentially at risk if the paint becomes decayed. So we, thankfully, we don't see a lot of reports of kids coming in over 100 or 80, but we still do pretty regularly get a 40 or a 50 or a 60 come in, which is considered a medical emergency. Mm-hmm. So we work with the doc to get that addressed.
Okay. Thank you.
And committee members, we will be hearing from the Sustainable Resources Center next, and maybe we should move to them because they're one of the groups that is actually working on this particular project. Unless there's any other urgent questions for these folks, why don't we go ahead and move to the Sustainable Resources Center. Thank you very much. That was a good overview, and I'm sure we'll have more opportunity to talk with you in the future about the Healthy Homes Initiative. I know there will be some legislation from at least a couple members probably. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Newman, if you want to introduce yourself and...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Newman. I'm the Executive Director of Sustainable Resources Center. SRC has been around for 35 years, and our mission is creating safe, healthy, and energy-efficient homes. And up here is Jennifer Prinz. She can introduce herself.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Prinz, and I'm with the Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership. We're based in Slayton, Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Prinz.
So in the interest of time, we'll move through here rather quickly. I want to briefly look at this slide. The Healthy Homes approach is well-documented, evidence-based interventions to address housing-related hazards. These are the kinds of things that we know have demonstrated returns on investment when it comes to health and housing. I've got with me a copy of a report funded by the Centers for Disease Control a number of years ago where they went through and they did a very thorough review of all of the evidence, and they established which of these measures and which interventions actually have demonstrated returns. And that's the focus of Healthy Homes work. It's stuff that we know that works and cuts future costs. Why is this important? It's about connecting the dots on public costs and benefits. Families in unhealthy housing are more likely to be poor, to be ill, to miss school. Asthma, for example, is the leading cause of school absences and the leading cause of work absences as well. The costs of unhealthy housing are embedded in our health and education systems. It affects our outcomes and it affects our costs. There are, for example, many studies that have shown that a high proportion of children in special ed have been exposed to lead as children. And the proportion is significantly higher than among children who are not in special education. And that's true around the country. So we're going to see these costs. We're incurring them now. And the future costs are going to be in medical expenses, lost productivity, and reduced incomes. Lead, for example, reduces intelligence at very low levels of exposure. So kids are just not as smart as they would otherwise be. And that has big consequences down the road. A year and a half ago, SRC and our housing partners started to look at the idea of forming an alliance around healthy homes and communities. We want to talk about the community and the home. They fit together, the house is in a place, and those things are important to talk about. We received some funding from the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota Foundation, and you can see from here we're really engaged with the housing folks. This is health and housing and public health and community development and energy people working together to find better ways of moving forward. I'm going to zip through some of these things and get right down to some of our recommendations. We had 265 people participate in a bunch of meetings from a variety of sectors. So this has been a very carefully and deliberate approach to engage people all over the state of Minnesota. This is the mission of the Alliance: promote, support, and provide healthy homes and communities. We just received an implementation grant for the Alliance from the Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation beginning January 1st. So the Alliance itself is just getting underway, but we've had all these people engaged in the planning. Our priorities: connecting people, programs, and sectors. All housing is local. All healthy housing is local. To make healthy housing work, you've got to have the connections where the development is taking place. It's got to be folks in that community working together to make things happen. And Jen's going to talk about some really great work, some award-winning work that's being done in southwestern Minnesota. So, five things we want to talk about in terms of future work here where the state can make an effort and make a real difference. One is best practice asthma care. There's all kinds of recommendations coming out from all kinds of organizations that asthma care needs to include a home environmental assessment and improvements in the home if we're going to reduce the long-term costs of asthma. And so the action that we're looking at is home environmental assessments and interventions as covered services for children with asthma. This is being done in different ways in Oregon, Massachusetts, Michigan, and New York already with medical assistance funding. Robust lead poisoning prevention. Last year, the CDC concluded there is no safe level of lead for children, and any amount of lead can cause irreversible brain damage. We need to keep the state monitoring that Dan Simonic was talking about. We need to keep case management assistance in place, and we need to expand the capacity of local public health to address these. So we're looking at medical assistance reimbursement for lead case management. This is also being done by other states, and then continuing the monitoring and case management supported MDH and bringing the enforcement of lead safe work practices into the state of Minnesota as opposed to leaving it at the federal level. Information training and technical assistance. Everybody we talked to around the state said they need some help with some things. They need information they can trust, they need general and specialized training, and they need technical assistance. And that's the kind of thing where we can do that to establish an information training technical assistance center that's available through non-electronic means. Everybody we talked to said you got to have a phone number, you can actually talk to a person. Not everybody is going to be able to do this on their computer. We need to make it accessible to folks most in need. Support for local leadership. The Healthy Homes model changes how we provide these services at the local level. It is about doing housing differently, not separating health and housing anymore. There's a lot of cross-sector efforts that are underway, and the action we'd be looking at is establishing a grant program for multi-sector local initiatives. So it's when people are working across sectors, they need a little seed money, they need a little capital to make those things happen. And finally, support for MDH leadership for Healthy Homes. MDH is very important here as we move ahead, coordination with other state agencies and establishing standards. One of the things we ran into around the state was we need someone to tell us what is healthy enough. You know, we need some standards if we're going to enforce healthy homes, if we're going to work on this, we need to be able to say what's good enough and how do we know. And that's a really great role for the Department of Health to play. There's a lot of work that's been done on this. So we want support for MDH to establish standards, coordinate across state agencies, and manage programs. So that's the things that we're bringing forth as ways that the state can really really spark healthy homes in this state and really start to achieve the benefits that have been demonstrated for 20 years across the country. And I don't know how to get to Jen's, I'm going to get technical assistance from, oh, you don't have, well then, here we are. I'd like to, unless there's questions, Madam Chair, we'll go to Jen.
And members, I'm sorry we're running a little bit over, but again, we started a half hour late because of the floor, so those of you who can stay, I appreciate it. And Representative Green?
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm going to have to leave, but there's one, a couple of questions that I'd like to ask first.
Sure.
The one is, I've taken some lead abatement training, and I agree, it's a big problem. But from the training that I've had, it seems like most residential houses quit using the lead paint in the early 60s. And the problem is more in maybe some of the buildings that used to be commercial or bigger buildings. Is this correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Green, the children's exposure is primarily through the home. And that's the exposure we're most concerned about. There certainly is lead in commercial properties and still paint, lead paint being used in some applications. Lead paint was banned in 78. When we go into houses, and we've done about 1,600 lead hazard control jobs in the last 10 years, so we've been in a lot of homes. If it's pre-1950, it's almost certainly to have lead. After that, it starts to diminish. But you have to look at the house. If the house has been had some significant remodeling, new windows, for example, there may be no lead hazards in it.
Representative Green.
I just want to make clear I wasn't trying to question you. It was a matter of is there a specific focus for you? And I guess you probably answered that. So
it's older houses with deteriorating housing conditions where the paint is no longer intact. The biggest source of lead exposure is lead dust. It's not the chipping and peeling paint you can see. It's the lead dust that comes off those friction surfaces of windows and doors. It accumulates in the window troughs and outside the window on the floor. Kids are hand to mouth. Little kids, right? They're on the floor. They're touching stuff. They're putting it in their mouth. That's where the lead exposure is coming from. It's usually not the stuff you can see. We had a guy in one of our lead safe work practices class, a construction worker a couple years ago, whose daughter was lead poisoned by the lead dust that fell off his tool bucket when he brought it in at night and set it in the corner of the kitchen. And that lead dust that he couldn't see fell off on the floor, and his kid was on that floor, and that's how she got lead poisoning. So, yeah, I mean, it's ubiquitous. Ubiquitous. If it's in your house, we need to, you need to test to find out.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Prinz, did you want to offer some testimony?
I'll just share a little bit about what's been working in Southwest Minnesota, Madam Chair.
And if you can speak a little closer to the microphone, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry, it's difficult when you're tall, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, I'm with the Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership, and green and healthy housing has been a part of what we do for almost 10 years. And it really started out really looking at the space and the environment where people are living. So really, looking at the conditions of homes. And this includes rental properties as well and making changes there. And Viking Terrace in Worthington is one of the first projects that we did, and I did include a summary that I don't know if you received, but that really describes the changes that were done there and the improvements to health that were measured as well. We worked closely with the National Center for Healthy Housing and with the University of Minnesota Center for Sustainable Building Research to really look at what changes made a difference to the residents living in Viking Terrace. And ventilation improvements had the largest impact there, and 37% of adults and 29% of children reported improved health conditions after the rehabilitation of that property. What's especially important, though, that we've learned since that time is that environmental changes can only go so far. There has to be a coordinated effort in terms of helping people utilize those systems, those changes, those technologies, so that they can reap the benefits of healthy housing. And especially in Worthington and other communities with great diversity, Worthington has a very high population of refugees and immigrants, that education and just understanding how a home works and what helps to keep our home safe and healthy, but then what some of these new technologies that even those of us who have lived in North American homes all our life, those technologies are new to us, and sometimes we don't make the best use of them either in helping keep our homes safe and healthy. So we, in conjunction with the seed money from Department of Human Services and Blue Cross Blue Shield, we worked with Southwest Health and Human Services, so with public health in five counties of Southwest Minnesota, to really help to build some coalitions for referrals and working with people that are already going into homes so that they are looking for those changes that can be made for families. So it's working with the public health nurses, with child protection officers, with fire safety, with building code officials, lots of different people that are already there and can help to make the referrals to connect people to the resources that they need so that we can make effective use of the limited resources we have for the interventions that families need. So we've, over time, moved from changing some of the spaces that people are in to really looking at education for utilization, improving their access, and helping to find appropriate interventions for the different problems that families face. Sometimes it's not a full rehabilitation of a housing unit. It may just be smoke detectors, some improved ventilation, some small changes. And sometimes those smaller things are harder to fund than the larger rehab projects.
You know, we went a little bit over, and there's another committee coming in. I wonder if you just want to make a concluding statement, either one of you, and then we'll have you back when we get into some legislation.
We look forward to working with the committee to put some of these ideas into action, and look forward to answering your questions as we go along the road. Thank you.
And I thank you for coming from Southwest Minnesota somewhere. Where did you come from?
I live in Worthington.
Worthington.
Yes.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that you
came.
Committee, we're going to adjourn, and then, again, please pay attention to the information you get on when we're going to have our tour next week. We really want your input so we can, as many people as possible can go. The meeting is adjourned.